Oh my goodness, that's composer, pianist, and vocalist Les McCann with something called Fish This Week, But Next Week Chitlins. what a name for a tune. It was originally released in 1960 on Blue Note. Leroy Vinegar on bass and Ron Jefferson on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Tuesday, March the 3rd, and we're doing a little bit of catch-up today because we are returning to the conclusion of a series that was begun by Professor Charles Lumpkins on black labor from the Civil War to the turn of the century, civil rights era, as it were. Just a couple of things to explain. We are still at PRN. We are still reconstructing ourselves after a terrible setback, a couple of setbacks, actually, that had nothing to do with PRN per se, but fate dealt a pretty heavy hand, and so the station is reconstituting itself. It's also moving to new space, so there's a lot going on. And in the meantime, what we're doing is we are doing what professionals do, is that we are going with the flow and we are catching up. As you know, quite a few programs that were scheduled on Lead Stories did not occur, so I'm trying also to revitalize those programs and get them rescheduled so that we don't miss out. So this is Toil and Trouble, Black Labor from the Civil War to the Civil Rights Movement. This is part four. Our guest, Professor Charles Lumpkins, concludes his presentation on African-American labor from the Civil War to the turn of the 21st century, covering the periods of chattel slavery, Reconstruction, the Gilded Age, and the Progressive Era. You might want to check the archives on Lead Stories at podbean.com for parts 1, 2, and 3, which aired on February the 5th, February the 10th, and February the 17th, respectively. Dr. Lumpkins is a lecturer of labor and employment relations at Pennsylvania State University, where he earned his doctorate in history in 2006. He's a young man. And he teaches there. He teaches history and African American studies. He also holds a master's degree in library science, which, of course, is evidenced in his extensive research. His scholastic research focuses particularly on the history of social and political movements and the history of the working class. Dr. Lumpkins is the author of the highly praised American Pogrom, The East St. Louis Race Riot and Black Politics, a necessary historical reference, I believe, for understanding the state of affairs in Ferguson, Missouri today. And with these remarks, I welcome you again, Professor Lumpkins, to Lead Stories. And thank you so much for your patience and your understanding in working with us as we work through our little challenge here.
Yes, thank you for welcoming me, Eutrice, and your little challenge. I hope it won't be too expensive.
No.
Spikes and such. And I thank you also for calling me young. I'll be 65 in August.
Ah, you're a young guy. You're young. You have at least a good 40 years left.
Easily.
Okay. Well, I want to tell you that this series that you've been doing has really reconfigured, at least in my mind, this whole notion about black labor, because we really, on a psychological level, we don't use that word very much, as in the sense of the dignified union understanding of the word labor. We have always interpreted black labor in the context of slavery. That is to say, it really wasn't labor, it was just free stuff. But what you have done so far in your presentation is bring to us the realization that this is not about slavery. Slavery is, we see the struggle of Africans in the United States to dignify their work and to protect the value of their work in so many different ways. So I want to thank you for that. That's a huge contribution right there, because usually we never, I would say we almost never really contemplate this question as a labor issue within, as I said, the context of the worth and value of one's toil.
Okay, I agree with what you said. Sentiments, yes.
Well, tell us where you're going to take us today.
Well, from my understanding is I will just basically wrap up in 10 minutes and then questions and answers or something of that nature.
Well, we wouldn't have the ability, as I was explaining, to connect with the audience today live. So we will have to take a rain check on the Q&A, but you can certainly stretch out and let us get an appreciation from your perspective as you summarize the points that you have made in each of these.
Okay, yes. Okay, so the wrap-up will take, I'll go longer than 10 minutes for the wrap-up then. Jumping off what you said about slavery, yes, most of Americans have been taught to think only of slavery and as far as African Americans are concerned, very rarely whatever happened after slavery. And in the civil rights movement that we have been taught to watch and understand, namely the major demonstrations, whether it be in Birmingham, Alabama, or the March on Washington, D.C. in 1963, we usually think of the civil rights movement as divorce or tangential to labor. But from 1619 to the present, the African-American history is largely the history of black working people. And labor does figure in very prominently. After all, the slaves came here, were brought here to work, so there's labor right there. And some historians have debated that, whether the first Africans were indentured servants or actually slaves in English-speaking North America. Their labor was bonded labor, and along with many white or European indentured servants, received the same treatment, the same conditions. And some historians say there were white slaves here as well. But things divided, bifurcated in the 1640s, 1650s, definitely after the 1670s, so that we only think of Africans and African Americans as slaves or in some cases freed people, and white working people as workers or laborers. But still, the whole labor question or the labor issues are very much intertwined. And bringing it up to where I left off in the 1960s, what was going on nationwide was that the transition. Again, in labor history, usually African Americans have been seen as and labor unions having an antagonistic relationship. To a certain degree, that was true. And that labor unions, mostly white or all white labor unions, basically excluded African American workers or treated them in segregated locals or did not welcome them into various industries, especially in skilled occupations. But when African Americans did become a significant percentage of certain occupations, labor unions really had to welcome them in. And when the Congress of Industrial Organizations, affiliated labor unions, began in the late 1930s, they too realized that they had to welcome African Americans, if for no other reason than a unified workforce under one union is better than workers split, divided, and being picked off one by one by employers or whomever. during contract negotiations or whatever. So the dynamics were changing from the 1930s into the 1960s. And the radicalism that came, that burst, well, it was always there, but it really burst on the scene in the 1960s, as far as the labor movement was concerned, really brought in a number of points of view that were very critical to labor unions as well as to the general labor relations between management and employees, management and labor unions. And like I briefly mentioned earlier, the revolutionary union movements basically centered in Detroit, but it spread to other cities as well. And these were mostly formations of majority black organizations, although some white workers or non-black workers did become involved in one way or another, if maybe as supporters, if not members of these revolutionary union movements. For example, the famous one that came first, I believe in 1968, was DRUM, the Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement, after the Dodge automobile manufacturer in the Detroit area, followed by FRUM, F-R-U-M, which is the Ford Revolutionary Union Movement, which was based at or centered at the famous River Rouge complex of Ford Motor Company just outside of Detroit. And then there were a few others like Aldrum, which is the Aldrich Avenue Chrysler plant, Cadrum, which is the Cadillac the Cadillac Revolutionary Union Movement. And I also read recently that there were some revolutionary union movements that were formed at non-automobile plants, like UPRUM, U-P-R-U-M, which is United Parcel Revolutionary Union Movement, and HRUM, or RUM, HRUM, H-R-U-M, which is the Healthcare Revolutionary Union Movement. These were mainly, again, black workers who were thinking along the lines that would be closely associated with, well, maybe the Black Panther Party in terms of spirit, the 1960s Black Panther Party, in spirit, in rhetoric, in outlook, as far as not only do we have to watch out for the capitalists or the industrialists, the bankers, we also have to watch the big guys. We also have to watch out for our union leadership, which seems to sell workers up the creek, especially black workers, or they're not looking out for workers' interests in general. And what's so interesting was that for FRUM and DRUM and ALDRUM and CADRUM, these were mainly automobile workers who were also members of the United Automobile Workers Union. And the UAW, at least the leadership under Walter Reuther, was very much pro-civil rights. They were in the forefront of giving labor support, or at least the moderate and liberal sections of the labor movement, support to Martin Luther King Jr., A. Philip Randolph, and others, Whitney Young and Roy Wilkins, Roy Wilkins of the NAACP, Whitney Young of the Urban League. And when King went down to Memphis, Tennessee in 1968 to support the sanitation workers, there was the AFSCME union, the American Federation of State, Municipal, County, State, Municipal Employees. So these were the unions that were very much pro-civil rights. And yet, what developed within these organizations were black workers who considered themselves politically radical or politically revolutionary, leftist revolutionary. And so the bringing a different critique, saying that, well, unions have to do more for working people generally and for working black people in particular. And this general trend was happening at the same time that, for reasons that I still haven't figured out, I'm still doing reading, that if you recall the civil rights demonstrations, especially the March on Washington, where people carry signs saying, well, we want jobs, decent jobs, we want freedom. Not one person was talking about affirmative action or anything like that. But yet, within a few years, maybe immediately after the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was enacted, there were individuals in government and even in some of the major civil rights organizations who were talking about what we now call affirmative action, even thinking of quotas, which was not the original intent of the framers who were thinking of affirmative action, but it snowballed into that. So some cynics believe that affirmative action was pushed to prevent any radical or critical thinking on the part of white and black and other types of workers who were saying we should not be fighting over the crumbs. We should be fighting to expand the economic pie, not to how to finely tune or finely slice the existing pie, which is slowly shrinking. Because in some industries, managements were thinking of outsourcing or offshoring, bringing their facilities or their manufacturing plants to other countries. Already that was beginning to happen in the 1960s. In fact, East St. Louis, I took some of my research about East St. Louis into the 1960s. That's when the city underwent rapid deindustrialization, so that by the 1970s, East St. Louis was really a shell of itself. The major industries, steel and meatpacking, aluminum ore processing, left East St. Louis, Illinois. Other areas of the country suffered deindustrialization during the 1970s, but East St. Louis was like the bellwether of deindustrialization. So, and that's when East St. Louis shifted from being majority white to majority black. Majority white, let's say 1960, to majority black by 1970. So these various things were happening to prevent a smooth unity, so to speak, or to make the civil rights movement and the labor movement meld seamlessly. It didn't happen, but since more and more black working people were becoming unionized, we see by the end of the 20th century a mirror image of the black experience within the labor movement. At the beginning of the 20th century, very few African Americans were members of labor unions, percentage-wise. Now, at the end of the 20th century, the largest demographic in the unions are black working people, mainly because it was the unions in the public sector, the government workers' unions, that expanded tremendously during the 1970s. And that's when African Americans, when they were entering into employment in large numbers outside of quote-unquote traditional occupations, or occupations that were traditionally set aside for black folks. When more and more black people entered into government employment, they also entered into labor unions that serviced the public sector. Although, if Scott Walker and others like him have their way, workers of all colors who are government workers will find themselves looking for other jobs because Scott Walker and his ilk, Scott Walker and his allies are interested in cutting back on government spending, which means cut back on employment in the government and government occupations. So As far as the search for dignity, that was always there. That was true for the labor movement as well as for African Americans seeking civil rights, human rights, the workers' rights. It's really, I was going to say two sides of the same coin, but let's say it's multiple sides of a hexagon solid or whatever. I'm just trying to think now what would be the best thing to say. That is, in some ways, what's happening in the economy in general since the 1960s. In fact, some people may say it even started before then, in the 1950s, when the big banks were telling various industries, you must invest elsewhere. You must make greater profits on your investments, which can be realized outside of the United States. When those decisions were being made starting sometime in the 1950s and definitely became apparent by the late 1970s, that was the time period when African Americans, even Mexican Americans and others who were traditionally outside of industry, were entering into what was left to industry. So that window of opportunity was rapidly shutting on African Americans, as far as greater numbers of them entering into the middle class, based on just industry, manufacturing, construction work, so on and so forth. And to be propelled into the middle class. And of course, what happened for white working people generally in the 1940s, thanks to the labor movement, and also thanks to Uncle Sam coming out with the GI Bill, the Servicemen's Adjustment Act, that was very generous to the returning GIs, many of whom were white men, who received a boost into middle class status with loans to start businesses if they want to, loans to go to college, loans to take out mortgages to buy houses in the suburbs. Some African Americans, veterans, received that, but many of the African American veterans could not capitalize on those benefits because suburbs were closed to them. Again, certain occupations were closed to them. And those who were in the South had a much more difficult time because de jure segregation, de jure discrimination was still in force in many of the Southern states and even some of the states outside of the South. So, a number of currents were going on simultaneously, and again to bounce off of what you said earlier in the introduction, as far as how we usually think of black labor only attached to slavery, it's only because there are so many other things that were going on that African Americans had to make up for lost time or make up for lost ground. In fact, the ground that was lost since Reconstruction, so that the whole issue of black labor would become very apparent, which obviously Martin Luther King Jr. made it very apparent in the 1968 sanitation strike in Memphis, Tennessee. But again, I want to leave listeners with the understanding that labor has always been a civil rights issue. And yes, there have been historians who said that the labor movement was also a civil rights movement back in the 1930s and 1940s. before the radicals, the socialists, the communists, the very left wing militant types were either purged or were told to shut up within the labor movement in the 1940s and 1950s, because those people would have kept pushing civil rights issues in the House of Labor, within the labor movement itself. Now, I just want to, let's see now, but for the most part, since the 1960s, more so in the last 20, 30 years, the percentage of African Americans have increased in union leadership positions, especially in union locals, or they have formed caucuses within the larger labor affiliations, like the American Federation of Labor - Congress of Industrial Organizations, AFL-CIO, or in various places like the old International Ladies Garment Workers Union, or the or for example, lately in the Chicago Teachers Union. They were there and always pushing not only for the bread and butter issues, hours, wages, working conditions, but also talking about social issues, justice issues, that unions should think about, if not focus on. And with the help and African Americans pushing in different directions to get into various areas of labor, of various careers or occupations that were either closed to them or that were limited to them. And we're talking various service sector jobs like hospitality and leisure, or in healthcare or retail, transportation. But the push was in that direction, and with the federal government strongly committed to civil rights, at least during the 1960s and into the 1970s, that really gave African Americans a push, a boost into a number of occupations, have a stronger presence in unions, so on and so forth. So that, again, when I mentioned the mirror image, where as far as percentage and numbers of African Americans were concerned in the labor movement, we also see a mirror image in the labor movement itself, labor unions, that by the end of the 20th century, at least on paper, if not, or in terms of rhetoric, if not actually doing things, more labor unions are on the side of civil rights, are on the side of racial equality or racial justice. Whereas at the beginning of the 20th century, that was not so. Very few unions were. And those unions that were did so because they had a significant percentage of members or a significant percentage of the workforce that they wanted to unionize were comprised of African Americans. And or other unions that were offering an anti-industrial capitalism critique. For example, in the 1870s, 1880s, it was the Knights of Labor. They wanted a cooperative society of some sort, and the abolition of wages, or the industrial workers of the world that wanted some type of socialism, a revolution through one big union. All workers, regardless of sex, gender, race, ethnicity, must unite. But those type of unions, and unions that were for racial equality or racial justice or some type of fairness among the different races of white of working people, they were small in number, few in number, but they were there. They were there. So the labor movement, I wouldn't want to say was schizoid, but it had its divisions. And that was mirrored among African Americans who were fighting for their rights too. Again, we see African Americans, black laborers, many of them did believe in unions, the idea of unions. It was just a question of, well, if unions weren't there for us, we would have to form our own unions or our own union locals or some type of organization that would approximate what unions are doing. That did happen. And when the CIO, as I mentioned earlier, became open to black workers, welcoming them, the idea of having black unions or black union locals fell by the wayside in some of these mass production industries like auto or steel or electrical manufacturing, so on and so forth. And but there was still that element of, can we really trust labor unions? And again, that would dovetail back to what I mentioned earlier about Drum and Frum and those other revolutionary union movements, black workers' movements. And for a short period of time, some of them became these Drums and Frums and Outdrums bandit came together to form the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, which, again, it was a small a period of time when these workers were thinking or organized in such ways that they were concerned about fighting on issues besides hours, wages, and working conditions. Okay. Let's see. Do you have other questions? Because I can go on. It was just...
Well, I would like you to just, to your satisfaction, just bring this, just bring us to the conclusion, and then you know what I mean. I don't want to rush where you are going, but you are laying out for us a series of interesting moves and developments that I don't think that people generally know about how African American workers in the United States, I mean, this continuing theme of defending the value of work and what they had to do to do that. If I were to ask a question right now, I would ask about you talked about the racial bifurcation, but what about the philosophical and psychological bifurcation, where for white workers, America was a land of opportunity, and it was almost automatic, because even though in the white world we still had that question as to who was white, because not everybody who was white was in fact white. Whiteness went through its own changes as well. Italians and people from the Mediterranean and whatnot were not considered white people in America. So in a way, that was a challenge to labor. But on the whole, the worker that was regarded as the white worker in America was also regarded as a person with rights, or the right to work, the right to the dignity of work. And others, it seemed to me that they were regarded as people who were placed on eternal probation. It was conditional whether you had the opportunity to work, and if you did, it was to be considered a kind of national benefit, a privilege that goes with being American. Do you see any change in this philosophy in the course of the period that you're talking about, where this was a huge issue about who had the right to work in America?
Okay, I see what you're saying, but the way I see it is this. Everyone in America had the right to work. I'll put the word right in quotation marks, though. Everyone was expected to work. Let's put it that way. Everyone should be working. the issue, of course, was for people who can only work or who were only able to sell their labor power and nothing else, or if they were slaves or indentured servants or prison laborers, they were coerced to work, but they still had to work. The question becomes really in this country, connecting work and trying to have dignity to work with citizenship. If you're not a citizen, then you have real problems in this country. At least that's been the experience of Americans for, I'd say, from the colonial era, definitely to the end of the 20th century. Maybe still going on now. I mean, we're having discussions about immigration today. So, and whether or not immigrants could be fast-tracked to citizenship, whatever that means. I don't know. I haven't really been following the details of that. But overall, as I remember, reading in some history books, the joke is, if you want to call it a joke, is that you're welcome to America as long as you can work. Or you're invited to America as long as you work. If you're not going to work, we don't want you here. And so on and so forth. But the big issue was, and the big fight was over citizenship. And for wage workers, people who sell their labor power in exchange for wages, every group that went through that process, regardless of color, regardless of race, regardless of ethnicity, regardless of national origin, had to wrestle with this issue of dignity, dignity at work, not being treated like a child or like a ward or whatever.
But African Americans, in this sense, are unique in that the very question of citizenship actually pertained specifically to them. Supreme Court decisions about whether Africans at all should ever be regarded as citizens of the United States or could ever be citizens of the United States. This was a central question to the civil rights movement that resonates even today.
Well, yes, the thought by Chief Justice Roger
B. Taney
of the Dred Scott decision, which in so many words he said, black people do not have rights that white men are bound to respect. Yes, that sentiment did continue on, no doubt about it. But the fact was the 14th Amendment was ratified in 1868. So it was etched into the Constitution that African Americans were citizens. Now, of course, how to enforce the full rights of citizenship so that African Americans can enjoy it? Well, people learn how to work around it. To give you a concrete example, take today's discussion about gun control. There are people who argue that you can't take away people's guns because of the Second Amendment. Whether you agree with that or not, the way to address that would be have an amendment to appeal the Second Amendment. Then it will be in the Constitution. Well, thank goodness there wasn't enough groundswell in this country to say, let's say, in 1877 with the Compromise of 1877 or in 1896 with Plessy versus Ferguson, there wasn't a groundswell to say, let's repeal the 14th Amendment, which basically said anyone who was born in this country is a citizen, which meant all African Americans were citizens. Instead, they had to figure out ways to get around that amendment. So that's the easiest way for people who want to beat the amendment, got around it. And of course, there are many different laws, local laws, state laws, even some federal laws that were passed in the Plessy versus Ferguson, saying separate but equal. But notice they stress equal, even though everyone at that time knew that was ludicrous. But if people want to fool themselves or want to tell themselves otherwise, they know that they couldn't get past that 14th Amendment and the 15th Amendment, which of course confer the right to vote on all male citizens. Women had to fight for their right to vote, which came with the 19th Amendment and ratified in time for elections in 1920. So we do have it, the law of the land, the Constitution. It's not perfect, but then what human institution or human laws are perfect? But they're there. And the civil rights movement, African-Americans who want to be considered equal in this country, who believe that they deserve their full rights and citizenship, always hung their hats on the fact that there was the 14th Amendment and the 15th Amendment, which basically, even though the 15th Amendment went to men, it did say you cannot deny people the right to vote based on race or color.
Well, you talked a lot about movement and organization of African Americans and others to organize on the basis of class. Now, I want to ask, with respect to the African American worker, was there a problem with class within the race, if you will?
Yes.
Could you talk about that a bit?
Yes. As far as social class is concerned, that's been there, definitely been there since the Civil War. And class became more of an issue among African Americans, although it's usually referred to in other terms, perhaps. But it was there, whether they'd be called lower class or ghetto people or whatever. There was always the upper crust and middle class type African Americans and the working class African Americans, the low class or the underclass among African Americans. Variations of those themes or the concepts been around all that time. The idea of racial uplift, which was a movement among African Americans for racial uplift, namely those people who are of the upper classes or middle classes or the betters. There was their duty to lead the race, to uplift the race, namely the masses, the unwashed masses, or whatever they were called, to live in better housing or to comport themselves better, to be more less loud or to dress better or to present themselves better, not only to their middle class or upper class members of the race, but also to white folks generally. So this racial uplift, it went under the theme of racial uplift, the concept of racial uplift, in the last two decades of the 19th century into maybe as late as the 1930s or maybe the 1940s or 20th century. And some variations of those themes do exist now. We see it in a way with when Bill Cosby, for example, before his latest problems, how he used to talk about black youth, their pants are down there, exposing the cracks of their rear ends or whatever. You know, those type of issues, of cultural type issues. Or Barack Obama talking about the black family needs to get its act together. We see these variations in one form or another over time. And the way it played out as far as African Americans or the majority of African Americans as working people, it depends on what's going on at a given time, at a given locale, because of the segregation, and it was legal segregation and the legalized discrimination. The class issues were at times papered over, but that's not the right term I want to use. The class issues among African Americans were pushed down, subsumed under the issue of race. But then that's how, that's the way it's been played in this country. Divide and rule. What's the easiest way to divide and rule people?
One of the most significant developments, I would think, especially at the turn of the last century, was the role of Marcus Mosiah Garvey in galvanizing not only African identity, but also consolidating its labor and its economic power. How did Garvey affect this organization of African Americans, the thinking about the value and the worth of their labor, but also about the political and economic implications of controlling their labor? How did he affect that? Because I noticed, of course, in the context of, you know, class problems within race, Garvey was virulently attacked by those of the who considered themselves members of the talented tenth, who divinely ordained to lead the masses. So how did that play out?
Well, obviously Garvey, he struck a chord. His movement, whether you want to refer to on whether you look at his all the various chapters, whether they were paper chapters or actual active chapters, the Garvey, his United Negro Improvement Association movement, attracted millions of people of in the African diaspora on both sides of the Atlantic, not only in the United States but the rest of North America, as you know. The Caribbean Basin, Central and South America, Africa, and people of African descent in Europe as well. In fact, from what I've read, it was the largest movement ever among people of African descent in the history, definitely in the history of the 20th century. More African Americans were active in the UNIA than, let's say, they were in the Civil Rights Movement. Now, in context of his times, Garvey would be considered, at least I saw him as, a nationalist. Only, you know, his nationalism was not tied to boundaries of any country. He definitely saw what the contributions of black folks to the Western world, African Americans, as workers, whether enslaved workers or freed workers, made tremendous contributions to the wealth of the Western world. And he wanted to see that energy challenge channeled for Africans. And that means people of African descent in the Western world as well as in Africa. And of course, he saw that the home base should be in Africa. But he definitely... again, he saw nothing wrong with black workers being organized, being unionized, but they should channel their energies toward, ideally, a black nation state. And definitely he would not be against the dignity of black labor. He himself was, I believe, a printer in his early years. And then, yes, he was definitely not in favor of W.E.B. Du Bois's concept of the talented tenth, this leadership the best and brightest, so to speak, or the fortunate among African Americans who became
the self-described leaders. Best and brightest.
Yes.
But also there was this rift. Marcus Garvey comes out of Jamaica. He is not a lettered man, but has incredible vision.
That's correct.
Has mobilized millions. His movement still has not been surpassed today in terms of organizing people.
That is correct.
And he was able to demonstrate not only the efficacy of it and the rationale for it, but the fact that these are tangible things. You can tangibly gain benefits when you take control of your labor, particularly because, of course, Jamaica at that time was a colony of Britain. And the whole history of colonies was that it's free labor, you know, the sugar cane of the Caribbean propped up the entire British Empire. So, and made, as you, I think you pointed out, that the sugar cane plantation owner in was wealthier in many cases than the British industrialist. So, when you have these kinds of clashes, and you talked about the divide and conquer, you have people like Du Bois and others, and this is not to, of course, malign them in any way, but these are the facts.
They
take these things very personally, and it even got to the point of, you know, personal vituperative attacks. So I'm suggesting here that in the context of your theme of the 20th century, we have in Marcus Garvey an outstanding example of the consolidation, if you will, of labor and the consciousness of the benefits of consolidating labor than at any other time in the history, in African American history.
Agreed. What helped Marcus, at least two things boosted Marcus Garvey's efforts, at least in the United States. One, he was building on the ideas of Booker T. Washington, which gets back to the Booker T. Washington Du Bois paradigm, conflict and so forth. So, but Washington had the upper hand. Washington died in 1915, just before Marcus Garvey came to the United States in hopes of seeing Booker T. Washington. So Booker T. Washington built a machine, so to speak, a base in many African-American communities. So there was some degree of receptiveness among African-Americans because of Booker T. Washington for Marcus Garvey. As far as labor was concerned, Booker T. Washington, he wasn't against black workers organizing unions or even joining unions, as long as those unions were fair to black workers. Now, that meant, at that time, many unions weren't. So he said to black workers, break when a strike goes on in those unions, with those unions, feel free to break their strikes because they didn't want you in the first place. And you need jobs. So that's, and African-American workers were careful about that for the most part, not to break strikes that were conducted by unions that welcome African-Americans, but you were free to break strikes conducted by unions that excluded or that segregated African-Americans. So there was that element there already among black working people. And Garvey, when he came along, and when he made his biggest impact, which was really during and immediately after World War I, was when this country refused to even contemplate about giving black Americans a fair shake. And that included many unions in the labor movement. So most black workers would gravitate and did gravitate to Marcus Garvey when everything else was closed to them. So, and Du Bois didn't really speak too much about black workers compared to Marcus Garvey. Marcus Garvey, he was the bridge between Booker T. Washington and most African Americans who believe in having control of the economic destiny. That would include the Nation of Islam, that would include Malcolm X after he left the Nation of Islam, that would include a number of black nationalist organizations, even those organizations that were part nationalist, part Marxist or whatever, like the early Black Panther Party, which talk about that black people should control their economic destiny. All these things can be traced back, really, to Marcus Garvey, who basically utilized and expand upon some of Booker T. Washington's concepts about economics, about labor. So, yes, very important, no doubt about it. Marcus Garvey is very important. He's not a dead end in African-American history, although you wouldn't think so when you crack open most history books and so forth. You think it was the Civil Rights Movement. But no, no, the ideas that Marcus Garvey and the UNIA advocated, percolated in many different forms and many different ways throughout African-American history, partly because he utilized Booker T. Washington, and he also utilized other concepts that people were pushing at that time,
well, we the have 1910s, to leave it there.
1920s.
We have to leave it there for today. I want to thank you so much, Professor Lumpkins, for having this historical conversation with us. And in so doing, giving us an idea that this question about black labor, how we look upon it, how we regard it, the value and the various permutations we went through as a society and as a people with regard to this specific question about how do we use our labor, to whose benefit, how do we value that, and how do we protect the value of what we produce. I want to thank you so much for this.
Well, thank you for your patience. I was that prepared today because I was expecting questions and answers. And
we will have to do that once our phone system is up and running again. Yeah. Certainly, I know people are going to be very much interested in talking to you and asking
you questions. And we just scratched the surface.
Oh, well, this is great.
Just scratched the surface.
But, you know, I tell you, you know, if I were a listener, this is college, well, of course, it is college level work, but it is also important for people to understand that these things that we take for granted, I mean, there's a huge and deep history behind them. So I want to thank you so much again for today.
And thank you for having me.
And we'll talk again about when we can have you back for Q&A with the audience. Thanks so much again.
Well, thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Professor Charles Lumpkins of the Pennsylvania State University. I hope this helped you think and rethink the business of labor. We dismiss it all the time, but this is a huge part of the history of America and the history of African people in America. Thank you so much for joining me today. And, of course, you can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. And on Facebook, Lead Stories with Utrice Lead. Keep it right here on PRN.FM. We're building back, and we'll be back in full force before you know it. Until then, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company.